TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Syria collapses. Ambassador Chas Freeman. Pascal Lottas from Neutrality Studies gets comments on the breaking news of December 9, 2024.
Hello, everybody. This is Pascal from Neutrality Studies, and today I'm coming to you with a special program about the unfolding events in Syria. It is the morning of December 9th here in Japan, and we just learned that Bashar al-Assad, the long-term leader of the Syrian state, has arrived with his family in Russia. It is now official. Damascus is completely in the hands of Hayat Arir al-Sham, aka al-Nusra. The Iran has evacuated its embassy, and the Russians are, according to their own statements, in talks with the rebels slash terrorists who are now in control of large swaths of Syria, even if not of everything. Here with me to discuss what all of this means is Ambassador Chas Freeman. Ambassador Freeman served as US Assistant Secretary of Defense and as US Ambassador to Saudi Arabia in the early 1990s, among his many other postings. Ambassador Freeman is really one of the great US experts, not only on US policy and foreign policy toward West Asia, but also about the region. So it is a great honor to have you here, Ambassador Freeman.
Very happy to be with you, Pascal.
Ambassador Freeman, when you heard about this rapid territorial gains that I don't know whether to call them rebels like our media does or to call them terrorists, but when you heard about this rapid success, what did you think? Because it took them 2 weeks to go from just a stalemate to basically controlling almost everything that Assad used to control before.
Well, I think it's still too early to tell exactly what the full implications of this are, particularly for Syria. But the implications geopolitically in the region are enormous. Basically, the big winner from this is Israel and the Netanyahu government. They have successfully pounded Hamas into the ground in Gaza, where they have not destroyed it, but it is on life support, as it were. They have decapitated Hezbollah and decimated its ranks. They have shown no regard whatsoever for the so-called ceasefire that they concluded with the Lebanese government. And now they have removed the logistical support for Hezbollah from Iran because the bridge to Lebanon has been Syria. This is a big loss for Iran. It means that its forward deployed deterrent forces, meaning Hezbollah, Hamas, in particular, the Houthis in Yemen are still active, of course, have been basically eliminated. So now it faces Israel directly with no capacity in Israel's immediate neighborhood to respond. This in turn raises some really serious long-term questions, because if Iran no longer has a conventional deterrent to Israeli attack or to counter Israeli efforts at regional hegemony, it is very likely that the voices which have been ever louder in Iran calling for the development of nuclear weapons will now overcome the religious scruples of the regime and achieve that. So this is a very dangerous moment in terms of nuclear proliferation, even though I haven't really seen that discussed publicly. It is not clear at this point exactly what the role of various foreign forces was in this stunning conquest of Syria by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, the leader of which was the al-Qaeda representative in Syria earlier. His nom de guerre, not his actual name, is Abu Muhammad al-Julani. Al-Julani means he comes from the Golan Heights, which are under Israeli occupation. And yet, apparently, this movement, which must have had a lot of support from Israel in its conquest of Syria, has promised to establish relations with Israel. And it will be interesting to see whether that pledge is carried out. I think the other notable aspect of this, among many, is that the forces that advanced against the Syrian National Army were very well trained, well led. They had a full panoply of modern weapons, including drones from Ukraine, suggesting that Ukraine saw an opening in Syria to hit back at Russian influence, since the Russians had been the prime supporters, other than the Iranians, of the Assad government. And they had tanks. This was not a guerrilla force so much as an organized conventional army. And their training and their equipment showed. On the other side, it is pretty clear that the internal divisions of the Assad government helped to bring about the rapid collapse of its resistance to this attack. I think it's important to note that the announcement that the regime had fallen, that the Assad family had fled the country, came from the chief of the Syrian armed forces. And the background here is that both Turkey and Russia had been pressing Assad on numerous recent occasions to make his peace with the jihadis, to try to bring some sense of unity to Syria, and he had refused. And it therefore is not implausible that both Turkey and Russia basically wrote him off. The Syrian army basically was commanded by its officers to lay down its arms and change into civilian clothing and not resist. So a final point is that this is a development in Syria that is remarkably free of mass bloodshed, because the resistance was so ineffectual or non-existent. This, in turn, reflects bad judgments by Bashar al-Assad in recent years. He came into office when, about 2003, I think, promising reform and a different regime than that of his father, Hafez al-Assad. And he didn't deliver. He basically instead became increasingly ruthless in his use of the security forces to prop up his government. Mr. al-Jolani, the head of the now triumphant resistance movement to Assad, who's about 42 years old, young, still vigorous, has apparently learned some important lessons. He's separated himself to some extent from the violent Islamist past that he represented. He has been considerate of Christians, among other things. He has been less inclined to slaughter Shia, but he is a Salafi Muslim. And we will now see whether, since he is basically in charge, although he has said he will defer to the choice of the Syrian people in terms of who governs Syria, you know, presenting himself as a liberation movement, which is indeed what Hayat Tahrir means, the Organization for Liberation of Syria. It is not clear at all whether he has changed color, whether he has, in fact, become what Western propaganda, which is gleeful about the fall of Assad, is saying about him, namely that he's a democratic liberal jihadi. This is quite a volte-face, but it is hardly to be unexpected, given the amazing ability of the Western media to present distorted views of reality when it comes to anything that goes on in West Asia.
Or what do you think about just this point, that now we see again how the West is actually, at least rhetorically, supporting an Islamist group, even an offspring of Al-Qaeda, the very group that is responsible for attacking the United States back in 2001, and so much US like military fighting went against, and that now this is being talked about not only so positively, but as you said, they had modern weaponry. Now, a lot of talk is that they received this support from Turkey, but even if so, some of it would at least have to have come some through some NATO channels from the West. Does this make sense to you in the strategic game in the region?
Well, you have to remember that, of course, Syria and Lebanon were created as separate countries by France in the colonial era. The French have a strong interest in what happens in Syria. I note that President Macron has expressed great delight at the overthrow of the Assad government. One has to assume that the French were somehow involved in this. Certainly the CIA must have been involved. The first CIA effort at regime change in Syria was in 1947, at the very moment of its inception. And there were multiple efforts to overthrow governments in Syria well before Hafez al-Assad took power. I think that was in the 1960s. Multiple efforts at regime change, they all failed. There were efforts, of course, to change the Bashar al-Assad regime, to overthrow it. Hillary Clinton and others famously advocated that. The United States CIA spent about $5 billion in training of various groups, including this one, to overthrow the regime, presumably on behalf of Israeli security interests, which have been foremost in the minds of the Biden administration, and certainly the incoming Trump administration promises nothing if not more of the same. So, as I said, there are many foreign hands in this. Precisely what role was played by whom is a little bit murky still. But finally, the effort to engineer regime change in Syria has been achieved. Let me just make another couple of comments. What we do not know at all is what the future Syria will look like. The objectives of the various parties have been different. The objective of the United States in the 1950s was to prevent communism from taking over, in other words, Soviet influence in Syria. We have been against the Russian presence in Syria more recently. The Israeli objective has been to fragment Syria into its component ethnic and linguistic parts so that it would not pose a threat. It would be this would be a classic divide and rule technique. The Turkish emphasis has been varied over the years. Sometimes good relations with Syria, when Turkey had a policy of no problems with its neighbors, sometimes violent opposition to Assad. The current Turkish interests, which have been at play in this dramatic set of events, include not only the elimination of the Syrian Kurdish factions that are allied with the terrorist PKK in Turkey and the removal of them from the Turkish border, but the return to Syria of roughly 5 million Syrian refugees who are in Turkey. And I think Mr. Erdogan tried very hard to make peace with Mr. Assad, mostly in the interest of removing the refugees from Turkish soil. But when Assad balked, he unleashed this force that his troops had been training. Now, one thing is clear, as I said at the outset, this is a major victory for the Israeli government of Netanyahu in terms of eliminating regional rivals and opening a path directly to an attack on Iran, which the Iranians must now devise a new method of deterring. This accords with the Biden administration objectives, which have been very much supportive of Israel, even in its genocide in Gaza, in its no re effective reaction to the pogroms and ethnic cleansing efforts in the West Bank, a support for Israeli invasion of Lebanon. And I can say if the biggest winner of this has been the Netanyahu government in a military sense, we should also remember that that government has done so many hateful things that it has made Israel the most hated society and country on the planet. And it has also sacrificed international law, every last shred of it, with the cooperation of Western powers. And it has destroyed the reputation of the West in the rest of the world for any kind of principled approach to humanitarian issues. So the costs to Israel in the long run are huge, but the military advantages that it has gained are quite substantial.
How is it possible that this was like an ultra-Islamist group is taking over these parts of Syria that were actually cooperating with Iran and with Hezbollah in order to oppose this genocide that's going on in Gaza. And I think this is what shocks the Iranians the most, that at this moment it is like through Turkey, through an Islamist group, that the support for Hezbollah and so on is being cut off, which were really, together with Yemen, the only ones who tried militarily to assist the Palestinians. How do you make sense of this, that it is Islamists who are now trying to find an accord with Israel?
It is, I should have mentioned when I earlier spoke of the CIA assistance to this group that I should have mentioned that it's very ironic that there's a $10 million bounty on the head of Mr. Al-Julani from the CIA. So one assumes that this is now going to be the subject of bargaining with him, that the United States will offer to take this bounty off his head in return for what? For a removal of the Russian presence, perhaps? I don't know. I mean, the Russians are now in a bargaining, as you mentioned, with the new authorities about their base, and particularly their naval base. We don't know what will happen, but that has been important to Russia in its diplomacy in West Asia, its influence, and it is the only warm water port that Russia really possesses. So this is important to the Russians. We don't know whether Syria will now be united under this Salafist regime, which claims to have a kind of tolerance it never previously displayed. The Alawite group, which is the group of really rather heretical Shia Muslims that Bashar al-Assad belongs to, must now be very frightened about what will happen. The Iranians have always regarded the Bashar al-Assad regime, the Ba'athist regime in Syria, as a secular apostate, not really Shia, not really associated with Islam. And while it is true that Hezbollah, which is now withdrawn from Syria, by the way, apparently withdrawn its troops, which had backed the regime of Assad, it's true that Hezbollah and others were backing the Palestinians in Gaza, but basically Assad did nothing. And in fact, he tolerated repeated Israeli airstrikes on supply lines going through Syria to Hezbollah in the Bekaa Valley and elsewhere. I think there are a huge number of questions now. And I note that Israel has reacted opportunistically to the chaos in Syria by seizing the demilitarized zone that the UN was managing between Syrian forces and its own in the Golan Heights. So it has taken the opportunity to annex more Arab land, in effect. The UN, is so sidelined. That I haven't heard anything from Secretary General Guterres about this. And yet, basically, Israel has once again thumbed its nose at the United Nations and resolutions. The resolution that created that demilitarized zone was a Security Council resolution, supposedly binding on all members. So there are a lot of loose ends here, and it will take some time for them to be untied or unraveled or whatever the proper word is.
So, what will happen on the humanitarian side, whether the Alawites will now see like mass persecution? That's something nobody can foretell, probably, because on the one hand, you're right, the regime that just is taking over now is famous for not respecting human rights. On the other hand, they are promising that they will do it. So who knows whether they are
We don't
actually
know.
going over and beyond themselves. But with Iran, so Iran is now properly isolated, aren't they? Like, this is,
Yes, they have been cut off from their major allies, clients, if you will. There's always been a great deal of nonsense spoken about Hezbollah and Hamas and so on. These are independent-minded organizations that reflect the views of the populations they represent. In the case of Hezbollah, it is demonstrably independent of Iran. Iran has actually historically been more of a restraining force on Hezbollah than anything else. But of course, now Hezbollah is on its own, basically. So we don't know what will happen there. Iran now faces a Trump administration coming into power in Washington, which is the second coming of the regime that overrode the Security Council approved JCPOA, or nuclear deal with Iran. Iran might, well, that probably will increase the likelihood of Iran trying a nuclear breakout in the near future. And of course, we're in an interregnum in the United States. We have a president who falls asleep at meetings with African leaders in Luanda, thus demonstrating that he is quite as senile as many people have thought, and incompetent. And we have Donald Trump, who is full of ignorant prejudices, I should say, rather than deep knowledge about foreign affairs, who has just threatened almost the entire world with a tariff war, and whose main interest in West Asia seems to be to have the Israelis wind up the whole thing. So I don't know what happens now. But if I were Iranian, I would be rethinking everything that I have been doing. And the irony there, of course, is that Pezeshkian, the new Iranian president, is a moderate who wanted to reach out to the West and was looking for compromise. And he's now been put in a position where compromise is utterly impossible.
If you look at the people, the picks for the incoming administration of Donald Trump, despite that he promised not to put in there the same people who led him to belligerent acts in the past, it seems to me that all that the new administration will probably do, and these people are not confirmed yet, but their names are out. Most of the new cabinet are actually just as much hawks or neocons as before, just not hawks in relation to Ukraine. The consensus seems to be that they want to wind down this war. But the other people that are coming in seem to me people who want to either have a war with Iran or a war with China. So it seems you exchange one theater for another. What's your impression?
Oh, I don't think that's not a wrong analysis at all. The people who are coming in are belligerent, bellicose. They're proponents of the use of force, except in Ukraine. I think they have a concept of trying to turn Russia against China, which is something that is, I don't think, going to happen. I don't think they have thought through the end game in Ukraine. The meeting in Paris just now between President-elect Trump and Mr. Zelensky apparently was accompanied by some fairly tough language about negotiating a ceasefire and so on. But I don't think the Russians want a ceasefire. I don't think they want a demilitarized zone in Ukraine. I think they want a peace in Europe, and they want a peace with Ukraine. And my own guess, and I have said this elsewhere, is that we are in for a Korean conflict scenario in which the fighting goes on while the negotiations attempt to arrange an armistice or some. But I don't think the Russians want an armistice. I don't think they want a DMZ, which would leave Europe in a position of constant tension and potential warfare and not provide for their security in a way that they demanded 2.5 years ago. It's almost three now, I guess, when they issued an ultimatum demanding negotiation of a European security architecture that would reassure them as well as the West. I think we're in for something in Ukraine that probably resembles nothing so much as the Peace of Westphalia, which took, I think, 3 years and was conducted in multiple forums. And they're different issues, you know. I mean, the Ukrainians and Russians have to work out a border between them. Nobody else can do that for them. We can complicate the process. But in the end, Moscow and Kyiv need to work that out. The question of minority rights in Ukraine touches on the OECD rules and guarantees of linguistic and cultural autonomy for minorities. along the lines of the Austrian State Treaty, if you wish, needs to be addressed in a broader context. I think the OECD, the EU, major countries in Europe have an interest in that. Certainly the Russians have an interest. The Hungarians, the Romanians, who have minorities in Ukraine who've been oppressed, have an interest in that. So that's yet another forum. And then there's finally the issue of the United States, Russia, NATO, major European powers, sitting down to try to work out some broader framework for peace in Europe. All of this is extremely difficult. And we have now, just this morning, it's Sunday here in the United States still, just this morning we had Donald Trump reiterate his willingness to withdraw from NATO. If he doesn't think the balance of payments connected with NATO is sufficiently generous. I think he has a point. We are, what, 75 years, almost 80 years after the end of World War II, coming up on 80 years after the end of World War II. And why is it that Europeans are incapable of defending themselves? Why is it that Europeans defer to a power across the Atlantic for every important decision? Well, of course, it's easy to do that. But I can understand the reason that the right wing in the United States says, why should we be carrying this burden? Well, of course, from the European point of view, we've not just been carrying the burden, but we've been getting Europe into trouble by the leadership that we have displayed. Anyway, I think we are at a moment in which multiple things in West Asia, the Middle East, if you will, in Eurasia, in Europe, are all in flux. And it will be very interesting, that's too mild a word, to see how this all plays out.
You heard excerpts from an interview of the retired ambassador, Chas Freeman. He served in the United States Foreign Service and the State and Defense Departments over the course of 30 years. Most notably, he was the main translator for Richard Nixon during his 1972 China visit, and he served as the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia from 1989 to 1992. Credit for this interview goes to Pascal Lotaz. He's assistant professor at Waseda Institute for Advanced Studies and adjunct professor for European politics at Temple University, Japan campus. Pascal Lotaz programs the YouTube channel Neutrality Studies, where you can watch the full-length interview. Search for the title, Syria Collapse, Israel Wins, Russia Setback, Iran Isolated and Closer to the Bomb. Ambassador Chas Freeman. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.